One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai. Kosai.org.
Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius, Tack Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the CS hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I am your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Iconic, Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We appreciate your amazing support. We know you've got options, 2 million options, I think. So to spend some time with us means a lot. We appreciate it. We couldn't do the show without the amazing support of our sponsors. Preparewithmacroaggressions.com is the landing page that My Patriot Supply created for us. They wanted me to let you know that for the first time in 3 years, they are having a sale on the 3 month supply of food. It is regular priced $897. It is now available for $647. That works out to a little over $7 per day for a family of four to be fed. This is a great price. If you're going out to lunch today, you're going to spend $7 just on yourself. This will take care of your entire family. For 3 months, we've got 120 pounds of food, over 2,000 calories per day. It'll last you for 25 years. So look, it's something to consider. Maybe exchange some of your soon-to-be worthless Federal Reserve notes for something with a little bit more value. Storable food is a good way to go. Take care of yourself. Take care of those people that are close to you. I've been very vocal about being proactive instead of reactive when it comes to things like this. So if you're in a position where you can take care of this now, you probably should go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com and just check it out for yourself. The link will be in the description. And as always, look, I just want people to be getting prepared. So if you do it through my sponsor, great. If you do it by adding additional food every time you go to the grocery store, that's great too. Just start thinking about this. We've got supply chain issues. We have food processing facilities just up and blowing up when they're not getting hit by airplanes. So this is weird. Let's be ahead of the curve and let's get ourselves ready. Also, thanks to C60 Purple Power. They've been our sponsor now for about 2 years. Thank you to them, to Ken the scientist over there. They're making the best batch of C60 available. What is that? It's a free radical sponge, a naturally occurring molecule comprised of 60 carbon atoms forming something that looks like a hollow soccer ball. It has the ability to neutralize free radicals, then reset itself again and again. It is the most powerful antioxidant known to man. It's several hundred times more powerful than anything out there. And the guys that discovered this, well, for their troubles, they wound up winning the Nobel Prize back in the 80s. So it's kind of a big deal. Do this. There's a link in the description, shopc60.com. And I suggest just go there and read up about it. See if it's right for you. You're never going to hear about it on the nightly news. They don't want you to take care of yourself, and they're not going to talk about these things. If you're there, use the promo code MACRO on your way out to save yourself some money. These statements and products have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, prevent, or mitigate any disease. Shopc60.com, promo code MACRO. Well, I'll tell you, I am extremely excited for our guest. I have been an admirer of his work for a while. He is an Oxford scholar. He is the author of 27 books. Is that right?
37.
37 books? I thought I wrote 3 books. I thought that was a big deal. That's like a rounding error to you. My goodness. You might have seen him on Dark Journalist very often. Mm-hmm. I watched him a couple of days ago. Of course, we are talking about Dr. Joseph P. Farrell. Hello, good doctor. How are you?
I am fine. Thanks for having me on, Charlie.
Thank you for coming on. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to know where to start with you because you cover quite a bit. So I'll tell you what. We'll get in our time machine. We'll go back several thousand years to Egypt because this has been a real focus of a lot of work that you've done. Now, when I was 16 years old, my father passed away from a heart attack while jogging. It was rough. It was traumatizing and all of that. When the school year ended, right before the school year ended, my mom asked me, she said, "We've had a rough year. Let's treat ourselves. Let's go someplace. You can go anywhere in the world. We'll make it happen. Where do you want to go?" And I said, "Egypt." I wanted to go to Egypt. I wanted to see what was going on there. So I've had this fascination with the place for a while. And this was the late 80s. So I don't know how it is now, but we went in the pyramids. We climbed on top of them. It was very accessible and spent several days in the Cairo Museum going through everything that we were allowed to see, of course. And I had a real connection with this culture. And I've never been back. I found your work on Giza Death Star. By the way, Dr. Farrell's website is GizaDeathStar.com for those that want to check this out. How did you get interested in Egypt, of all places?
Well, it's kind of one of those weird stories. My father was a construction engineer, and my parents used to play cards, you know, back when people would play cards, with some friends of theirs in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He was also the engineer for the local CBS television station. So, you know, you get two engineers together and they talk shop. And I remember when I was a very young boy, they were playing cards over at my parents' house, sitting there listening to them. And my dad and the other engineer are talking about the Great Pyramid and what a wonderfully engineered structure it was. And no way was it built by Egyptians using saws and blocks and diorite chisels, you know, all the paraphernalia that Egyptology says that they used. So I've had a fascination with it from a very early age. Then what also kind of fueled it is my parents were also big, huge travelers. And I remember on a vacation once, we were driving up, this was in the 70s, we were driving up through North Dakota, and the United States had begun building the anti-ballistic missile system. So if you drive out in North Dakota, I think it's still there to this day, but Nixon signed the SALT agreement, which abandoned that ABM system. So out in the middle of North Dakota, there's this big pyramidal structure. It looks kind of like the Great Pyramid. It's got half of it lopped off. Mm-hmm. Okay. But you see this structure off in the distance, and it was a phased array radar antenna is what it was. And I remember thinking, oh, isn't that interesting? You know, And so I got interested in the pyramids just because, you know, and there's a lot of weirdness out there about the pyramid, too. I won't deny it. And then later on, so it's a kind of a three-stage process for me. Later on, I read Zechariah Sitchin's book, The Wars of Gods and Men. And right about the same time I was reading this, Christopher Dunn, a British-American engineer, published a book called The Giza Power Plant. So I'm sitting there reading the Wars of Gods and Men by Zechariah Sitchin, listening to Coast AM, and Art Bell is interviewing Chris Dunn about his new book. And I'm thinking, holy cow.
Yeah.
So, you know, I went out and bought Christopher Dunn's book the very next day. But anyway, the interesting thing about Sitchin and what really kind of started all this off for me is, number one, I've never had a good feeling about the Great Pyramid. Now, I've never been there, but I've seen pictures of it, and there's just something about it that always rubbed me the wrong way. And so I'm reading Sitchin, and he's reading this ancient Mesopotamian text called the Epic of Ninurta. And he's tying the text to the Great Pyramid. And very clearly, and this is what really grabbed me, very clearly, Sitchin and his text is interpreting the structure as a weapon.
Whoa.
And I'm thinking, holy cow. And not only a weapon, but the text itself is calling it the Great Weapon. The Great Weapon is lifted up, and on, you know, all these bizarre descriptions of the thing and what it did. And no one, including Sitchin himself, I think, really latched on to how important or significant that might be in terms of its implication. And so the genesis of those three books, which just incidentally went out of print, by the way, so I'm in the process of trying to get them reprinted. But that was the genesis of this, because I thought, well, if you've got a structure that is that enormous, that in a certain sense makes sense, because the biggest spending that we do to this day is military. Yeah. But I decided, well, I'm going to have to look at this hypothesis to see if it makes any sense. You know, okay, it was a weapon, but what kind of weapon was it? Mm-hmm. And on we could go. So that was basically the genesis of the books.
Well, I have been to the pyramids, and you get simultaneously this feeling of insignificance when you stand next to it, and the sheer right. size of it. You know, yeah. it's hard. You feel insignificant, but at the same time, you feel, wow, we did this.
We did
this. We could do anything, right? And then you go about your life with this belief that we did this, and then you start to go, well, I found myself making a hard ride into the alternative history world, I guess. I don't know, conspiratorial research, however you want to frame it. But I start to ask myself, well, did we build this? How did we build this? It wasn't slaves. I don't think that makes any sense, dragging these. I mean, it's nowhere near any sort of quarries or whatnot. And there's multiple pyramids and the Sphinx. We have to keep that in mind. And then you come across Joel Anthony West's work, Graham Hancock. These people start talking about, you know, I'm not really sure about the date of the Sphinx in general. There's water erosion. You go, okay, what is going on here? If the Sphinx is from a different era than the pyramids, then what is the story we're being told? Then you find the gatekeepers of Zahawas in Egypt that say, no, no, you're only allowed to think this way.
This way.
You think outside of that is we'll get you banned or yelled at like Graham Hancock did or whatever. So what are we to make of this? Is this something that was built by humans? Was it built by humans using some sort of unusual technology, sound levitation? I've heard all those stories, water, rivers being formed. And where do you stand on this?
Well, I think I know more or less what you're asking me. I am not philosophically opposed to the idea of extraterrestrials.
However,
I have yet to be convinced that a good physics case has been made that an absolutely irrefutable one, other than in a couple of instances that we've been visited. I take the view, and I have outlined this in several of my books, I take the view that there was once in high antiquity a very advanced human civilization. Mm-hmm. And I further take the view that that civilization may have been interplanetary, and it may have been in contact with what we would call extraterrestrials. I call them the genetic cousins. Okay. Because it's very clear that if you go back in ancient human records, that and if you take them seriously and at their word, that we were talking with somebody that looks like us and walks like us and quacks like us and so on and so forth. Depending on the record, they were humanoid in appearance, but much taller.
Right.
And to me, that would indicate, okay, well, maybe they're from a much larger planet with a higher higher gravitational field. You know, on and on we could go.
Right.
But I take the view that there was a very sophisticated civilization in high antiquity with a scientific development as advanced, if not more so, than our own. And I take the view that they quite literally fought a war and blew themselves up. You know, this is what got me started with Sitchin, because that more or less is what he's saying. What I find very interesting about Sitchin's work is that, you know, academics, or as I like sometimes to call them, quackademics,
yeah.
Got all over him for his translations. So what I also attempted to do in those books is use English translations of the very same texts that were done by academics, and pointing out that it doesn't matter what translation you're using. What really is interesting is you can still read these texts and read them as describing some sort of very advanced science in the only language that they had available in their time. So that's more or less my view.
It's fascinating because we've got, we've got this asteroid belt that shouldn't be there.
No.
The speculation is that it could have been, or maybe was, an exploded planet.
Uh-huh.
To say there's questions about Mars would be an understatement. We have monoliths on Phobos. We have all sorts of unusual activity. What do you think? Where are we? I know, and I fully understand we're setting sail for Speculation Island here, but allowing, how does this work? Were we here? Were we on Mars? Were we on Maldek? That's the exploded planet. Was that the exploded planet?
The exploded planet was Tiamat, and that is Sitchin's chronology. What I find very interesting is that, you know, and please understand, I'm not in agreement with all the details of Sitchin's scenario. I'm just not.
And not required, right?
I want people to understand that what grabbed me about Sitchin was his interpretation of that one text in reference to the Great Pyramid. Right. I'm not a believer in Nibiru, you know, a planet popping through the solar system every 3,600 years. You know, the physics doesn't work for that in my mind. So, you know, that's the way I'm thinking. The exploded planet, it was actually the former U.S. Naval Observatory astronomer, a fellow by the name of Dr. Tom Van Flandern, that revived the idea that the asteroid belt was an exploded planet. That was actually an idea that astronomers had at the beginning of the 19th century when they were looking at the Titius-Bode law, which is a law of astronomy that was well known to astronomers in the 18th and 19th centuries, that is a way of predicting the location of planetary orbits and their probable masses based on the harmonics of local space-time. It's a very simple idea. And that law predicted that there should have been a planet in the asteroid belt, but obviously there's not.
Right.
When the astronomers first discovered the first asteroid, that's when they started to think in terms that somehow that planet, which incidentally they named Krypton,
Of course they did.
Of course they did. That somehow it blew up.
Right.
And so along comes Dr. Tom Van Flandern in the late 20th century, and he revives that whole hypothesis, because what he did was he started looking at the orbits of comets and more or less running the program backward to figure out, well, where do these things originate? When did they start? So running his program backward, he came up to an origin somewhere in the asteroid belt, and two, an origin sometime either 65 million years ago or 3.2 million years ago. Okay. And then he decides, well, obviously they're part of the same blown up planet. And I'm compressing massive amounts of his argument for trying to revive the exploded planet hypothesis. But one of the most interesting things in his book, it's a book called Dark Matter, New Comets or something. I can never remember the title because it's one of these academic titles. But one of the most interesting parts about the book is you can tell that he's trying to figure out, why did this planet blow up? And you can tell he does not want to come to the conclusion he comes to.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first thing he says, well, maybe somehow there was a natural fission reactor that went critical and it blew up. Okay, now we've got natural fission reactors out in the middle of Africa, on planet Earth. The problem with fission reactions like that is they're just not big enough to blow up a planet. So then he says, well, maybe it was a really, really big hydrogen bomb, you know, a malfunction in the planetary core and kablooey, it went off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, hydrogen bombs you can build to any size, but again, we're asking that this happens inside of planets. And no planetary physics really says that we've got stars in the center of the planet. So then the next model he comes up with is an antimatter matter separation containment in the middle of the planet. And he doesn't explain to us how we get the antimatter in the first place. He just hypothesized, well, maybe it was an antimatter matter reaction when containment in the center of the planet broke down and kablooey, there she goes. And I'm thinking, oh, come on. You know, I'm reading this and I'm thinking, oh, come on.
Right.
For one thing, the relationship of matter and antimatter in the universe is not isotropic. It's not equal. Okay. So finally, he says, and then you know, you can just kind of hear him sighing and saying, "Well, there's always the possibility that it was the result of," and here are his words, "deliberate action."
Okay.
And the moment you say that, you're either saying, okay, it was an accident. It was an experiment gone wrong. You know, somebody messed up, or somebody pressed a button and blew it up, George Lucas style in Star Wars.
Okay. Yeah.
And you know me, at that point, I'm thinking, well, somebody's pressing a button and blowing the thing up. Now, the problem here is that Van Flandern is working solely on the basis of his astronomical and astrogeological examination. He's not the slightest bit concerned, or probably doesn't even know of the existence of these ancient texts that are talking about cosmic wars, okay? Other than maybe Greek mythology. But when you put that with those texts, what you've got is a scenario that there's a war being fought, someone pressed a button and blew up a planet, and here we are.
So that's
one way of looking at it. You know, I wrote a book called The Cosmic War, and to me that book is and was intended to be kind of the keystone in the arch of all my books. In the book, I point out that, I review Van Flandern's hypothesis. But I also point out the moon Iapetus of Saturn. Have you ever looked at that thing?
Yes. It looks like it's welded together.
Well, it not only looks like it's welded together, but it bears a peculiar, suspicious, creepy
to the Death Star.
To the Death Star, and yes, you know, it just, and you're wondering, okay, George, how did we come up with that? You know,
yeah,
and you know, so yeah, there's all these indicators and clues in the text, and I think in the solar system that number one, there was a civilization here. That was very old. Number two, it was interplanetary. I don't think you can look at some of the Derritus on the moon or Mars particularly and not come to the conclusion that somebody left an awful lot of junk there.
You know?
Yeah. You can't look at things like Iapetus and conclude that this is an accident. So on top of all this, you have all of these texts, human traditions from the Greeks to the Mesopotamians to the, you know, Indus Valley civilizations in India and so on that are talking about cosmic wars. So, you know, I'm simply, attempting to put it all together in some fashion that makes some sort of sense.
I've heard you and Daniel talk about this on Dark Journalist. I have interest in remote viewing as well. Mm-hmm. I've watched Farsight Institute. Yeah, speaking of Iapetus, they've done an episode where they remote viewed a building there that they said that they described as not being military, not seemingly having any sort of military function, but they described it as a resort. They said, well, that's where you'd be if you wanted to have a view of the best view in the solar system of Saturn at this particular angle. And of course, so I'm curious, what is we know about SRI, we know about Pat Price and the men who stare at goats and all this. What is the, how much can we, or should we at all, rely on remote viewing to figure out, to fill in some of our gaps?
Well, I'm not opposed to the idea of remote viewing. I tend to think, there are very, very old traditions around the world, spiritual traditions, and they, you know, some of those traditions enter Christian monasticism. It's not unknown for the Christian monks to write about things like clairvoyance, clairaudience, and things of this nature. What I think we're looking at, in actuality, Charlie, is a kind of a natural faculty of human nature. It's something that we all have, but it's been so dormant in most of us that, you know, we don't know how to use it, or we're not aware of it. You know, we may experience it, you know, in a kind of undisciplined way with intuitions or deja vu, you know, experiences like that. So I'm not opposed to the idea of remote viewing. My one caution that I have always said for people is that this cannot be a sole or primary source of information. I don't use it when I write. I'm a documents guy. You know, I think and I footnote. And, you know, that's what I do. And when I'm speculating, I tell people I'm speculating. If I rely on information like that, I can't think it right off the top of my head where I'm relying on anybody else's stories of remote viewing or so on. But if I do rely on that type of information, I try and let people know, okay, we're speculating here. This is not your standard type of evidence to enter the data stream and so on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you've always been very clear about framing it as high octane speculation as opposed to, you know, this is something I can prove. And I think that there's a place for that. Of course, I do the same thing. I try to be differentiate when I'm this is what I'm thinking, but I don't have anything to back this up. And I think that's okay. I watched as you guys have really come to enlightened me on a topic that I felt like I knew a little bit about, and then I realized the more I listened, you know, the more I listened to you, your work or others surrounding this, I realized I probably need an education on this. It's regarding World War II. And I think, is it fair? Would it be fair to say that Germany lost the war, but the Nazis didn't.
Yeah, I take the view, if you look at the surrender of and I do this in a book of mine called The Nazi International. Yeah. I compare the German surrender to the Japanese surrender. If you look at the German surrender and examine it very carefully, what you have surrendering is the German Wehrmacht, the German armed forces. Okay. On May 7th, it's Colonel General Alfred Jodl, who was the chief of operations for the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, that's surrendering in Reims in France. Okay. And he's dispatched to do this by the successor to Hitler, Grand Admiral Dönitz, who himself is, you know, was at the time until Hitler's death.
Right.
Dönitz was in charge of the German Navy. He was the guy that ran the U-boat campaign. So Dönitz, you have a military man dispatching another military man to conduct the surrender. Then the surrender is repeated on May 8th in Berlin so that the Russians can be in on it. And again, what we have, if you look at that surrender ceremony, very famous picture, you've got Field Marshal Keitel, Admiral von Friedeburg, and Luftwaffe General Stumpf, I believe it was. So you've got the three main military branches of the German armed forces doing the surrendering. Okay. Now here's my point. Who and where is the representative of the Nazi party?
Oh, interesting.
No one. No one is surrendering. No one is representing the Nazi party. Okay. That's problem number one. And then problem number two is at those surrenders, no one is surrendering for the German Reich. Hmm. In other words, no one is surrendering for the state. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. You know, if you're going to surrender, you better dot all the I's and cross all the T's.
Right.
So you can, and this is exactly what happens in the Japanese surrender. If you look at the surrender of Japan, the people surrendering are surrendering on behalf of the emperor, the imperial diet, the imperial general staff, the imperial navy, and basically everybody who should be surrendering is surrendering. Okay. In other words, there's a signature, there's a representative for each of those things.
Right.
So I'm thinking, whoa, something very bad here is going down. So long and short of it is I put that together with the fact, and it is a well-known fact. I'm not, I'm not making this up or I'm not unique in pointing this out by any stretch of the imagination, that after Stalingrad, when it becomes clear to the Nazi leadership that barring some sort of secret weapons miracle, they're going to lose the war, The Nazi leadership begins laying very elaborate plans for a strategic evacuation of Europe and for the continuance of the Nazi party. In effect, if you look at what they did, is they set up a financial infrastructure that was international, and I mean international.
Yeah.
They set up a financial infrastructure that was international in its scope that would allow them, and this is the key point, that would allow them to continue some of that secret research that they were doing in the war. So they basically, what I'm arguing is that they basically constituted themselves as an extraterritorial state.
Hmm.
And basically, if you want to know why the world looks like it's going fascist, that's my argument for why.
Yeah. Yeah. They've regrouped, refortified, and now they're back.
Well, and now they're back.
Look, I've made this case in several episodes that I think, you know, are we talking about the Fourth Industrial Revolution or are we talking about the Fourth Reich? Because what the World Economic Forum is doing has some fingerprints that feel very, you know, goose steppy to
Nazi.
Me.
I'll come right out and say it.
I mean, We've got, I mean, even down to Klaus Schwab and, Escher Weiss and the relationship that his father had in Switzerland with all of these guys and the manufacturing components. I mean, there's Nazi fingerprints all over his operation, as we know.
Oh, yeah. I absolutely agree. His father was a general in the German army. You know, I've got a picture of him somewhere on my website of Klaus Schwab and his father in his general's uniform. And I'm thinking, and my caption is, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
You know? Right. And the company was named, I forget what the exact termination, the designation was, but it was one of the Reich's most trusted partners with the corporation.
Well, his father worked for the Dessau Corporation. Mm. I think that was the name of it. It's a corporation that begins with a D, and now that I think about it, that's not correct. But that same corporation, if you dig into its history, was intimately involved in the Third Reich's atom bomb and hydrogen bomb projects, number one.
Yes.
That same company, if you really dig into a book that was published by the New York Times, no less, in the 1970s, that same company was the company selling its uranium enrichment technology to South Africa.
Yes, it was.
Yes, it was. You know, what people have to understand is Germany closed the nuclear fuel cycle shortly after World War II and suspiciously early, and by some accounts, even before West Germany was a country again. Wow. You know, so what does that tell you, folks? You know, just so I'm clear for everybody, I do believe that the Nazis attained the atom bomb during World War II. That's another one of my little revisionist history contributions to the field. But my point is that the Germans have closed the nuclear fuel cycle and had it for a very long time.
They did.
And if you want to know who is behind a lot of nuclear proliferation, you know, when you think of Iranian centrifuges, you can also think of German centrifuges.
Yes.
You know, on and on we could go. Klaus Schwab is, to me, he's just kind of the contemporary German headquarters of this Nazi international outfit.
He sure is. These guys are, we watch them. So they make their break. They make their escape after Stalingrad. They run into that real determined, Soviet group that says, we're not giving up this place. You can fight us in the winter. We're going to stay here. They pull back. They plan their exit. They load up U-boats. They head to South America. Do they head to Antarctica as well?
Well, This has always been a thing that I've had to combat, because there are these people out there that believe the Nazis had zero point energy and were building flying saucers in Antarctica, and on and on and on. None of the evidence that I have put together in my book suggests that it was even remotely possible for the Germans to build a secret UFO research laboratory and production facility in Antarctica. We're asking this to be done during the war, under wartime circumstances, by a Navy that is nowhere near the size of the British or American navies. You know, now, did the Germans have something in Antarctica? Answer, yes. Probably it was one of these little automated weather stations that, like, they planted in Canada and, you know, everywhere else, so that they could run their U-boat operations. But the idea of a facility like that in Antarctica, no, I just don't buy that, and never have. That said, with that caveat on the record, whatever they were doing in Antarctica, and they were doing something, it's a mystery. No one knows. Because we had that 1938-1939 expedition that the Germans ran to Antarctica. And guess who's in charge of it?
Who?
Hermann Göring.
Oh, no. Oh, no. No.
He's the bad guy. Hermann Göring is not interested in running a science project. Mm-mm. To find out about Antarctica. The cover story at that time as well, Göring is in charge of the four-year plans, and he's interested in running this product because they need oils for lubricants and they need whales. And I'm thinking, no, if Hermann Göring is running an expedition to Antarctica, there's something else he's interested in.
For sure.
So anyway, and on top of this, when you dig around and search and sniff long enough, you'll find someone else has their finger in that German Antarctic expedition. And guess who he is?
Is it von Braun? No.
Rudolf Hess.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, this was clearly they weren't there to
they're doing more than trying to find whales and fishing grounds.
Measuring ice.
And measuring ice yeah. flows.
That's yes. not happening. No.
No.
They want to see if they can put a military base there. But look, you make a deal with the devil, maybe the literal devil in this case, when you're dealing with these Nazis, right? They come, right. The war ends. And then the it's like the NFL draft. We start drafting Nazis. You know, we start picking. We want this guy. We want this guy. So we went pretty heavy in aerospace.
Right.
And I guess, you know, to the winner, the spoils go to the victor goes to the spoils. And we've got access to some really top minds. We've got.
Now, let me stop you,
please.
Because I've been arguing for many years, based on the books I've written about this subject, that it looks to me that the Nazis themselves are driving the division of the spoils. In other words, they're fixing the NFL draft, to use your analogy. Okay.
That's a good question. That leads to my question, because Russia took guys too. How did that process work?
What happened? It's very simple. If you look what the Soviet Union is getting and what the United States, to a lesser extent, Great Britain, Canada, and France are getting, if you look very carefully, you'll notice a pattern. The pattern is the Soviet Union is getting the middle echelon managers. In other words, the Soviet Union is getting the draftsmen, mm-hmm. the guys that can reconstruct the document trail. They're getting hundreds of these people. Who are we getting? We're getting the big names. We're getting the Werner von Brauns, the Hermann Oberts, the Rudolf Strugholz. All of these people are the people that we're getting. So if you look at that division of the spoils, it's almost equal. Mm. It's like they're setting up the United States and the Soviet Union to be at law. And I believe absolutely that's what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Because there's another component to this post-war Nazi international, and his name is General Reinhard Galen.
Yes.
Galen is the man that was head of Germany's military intelligence on the Eastern Front. Now, what that means in practice is he's running agents all the way to the Ural Mountains and inside of Siberia, inside of the Soviet Union, and he's also responsible for running all of the intelligence that's being conducted by the Bielorussians and the Ukrainian SS units and so on and so forth. Hint, hint, hint. Yeah, there's a connection to what's going on here now, folks. Now, Galen takes this whole organization, goes to the Americans, a fellow by the name of General Siebert, and ultimately, of course, this makes its way up to Alan Dulles and, you know, that ilk, that crowd. And Galen presents them, and you can, by the way, I'm not making this up. You can read about this because Galen published his memoirs and puts all of these points right there in the memoirs. He goes to the Americans and said, look, you guys need some intelligence on these Russian guys. I've got the network. So here's the deal. I'm going to turn the network over to you, number one. Right. You guys are going to set the agenda of what sort of intelligence you want us to get for you, unless, of course, it conflicts with German interests. And number three, you guys are going to pay for it. And we're going to do all of this analysis for you and so on, unless, of course, it conflicts with German interests. In other words, this is the codicil that we accept. So we're paying after the war, we're paying for a Nazi intelligence network in Eastern Europe. And to show you how bad it is, and I'm not even the one that makes this observation. This is made by an American historian by the name of Charles Ogilvy. He points out that Galen's network at the time is so powerful that basically, number one, the CIA is nothing but a front for a house of Nazi spies. Mm-hmm. That's his assessment. And number two, it's so bad that the CIA is taking Galen's intelligence assessments. And this just blows my mind. Taking his intelligence assessments, typing them up without any further revision or commentary on CIA stationery and handing it directly to Harry Truman. So you have a Nazi general and a Nazi network of spies briefing Harry Truman on Soviet intentions. Do you see a problem here?
But isn't that the best money we could have spent, though, to get network of the to just step in right away and have that?
But here's the problem. As you know, money is a very bad way of ensuring loyalty.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, the Russians were running so many double agents inside of Galen's network. And I rather suspect that when push comes to shove, there were lots of triple agents that were working for good old Germany and nobody else all along. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, we see this independent pattern of German intelligence all the way up to, you know, to the Iraq War and the Baghdad Museum looting, as far as I'm concerned. So this post-war Nazi network, or what I call the Nazi International, I literally view it as an extraterritorial state, because that's the way it acts.
Well, they couldn't very well claim Germany, right? So they're not even, I mean, are they, they're out of Germany?
I think Germany is still a part of their operation, but it's no longer, so to speak, headquarters. Where the headquarters is, I have no idea. They've got their foot in Taiwan. They've got their foot in Indonesia. They've certainly got their foot in Latin America. They've got their feet in Switzerland. They've got their feet in Germany. You know, this is an international organization, and it's fascist, folks. So there's no other way to slice the bread.
So we got ourselves a built-to-order intelligence network.
Uh-huh.
And we got ourselves a ready to go, right out of the box space program. Not bad for parachuting into the last year of the war, right?
Not bad, except here's another problem. Vis-a-vis the space program, I tend to think that there's a public space program that we see with the bottle rockets.
Right.
And then there is a secret space program that involves the really cool exotic technology that they don't want anyone to know that they have. Yeah. Okay, that's it in a nutshell. The interesting thing is, if you look at that kind of two-track space program, it goes again all the way back to Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. Because you've got the rockets, obviously, you know, the V2, the V1, all the television guided missiles and all that other stuff that they were doing. But at the same time, they have some truly extraordinary, exotic, weird stuff going on. You know, my favorite being the Nazi Bell, which I wrote a book about. they're doing all sorts of just very, very bizarre, out of the box thinking inside of Nazi Germany. So you've got basically kind of a two-track system of all of this secret research. You've got the really secret stuff that no one knows about, and then the secret stuff that they kind of let everybody, oh yeah, we've got this, you know, that right. They let everybody know. But we pick up on that in this country.
Well, you guys have been doing fantastic work on this. I would say put you, Daniel List, Dark Journalist, Catherine Austin Fitz, mm-hmm. Professor Mark Skidmore and Fitz, of course, the two of them on the missing money.
And oh, huge.
When you dig in, you find DOD and HUD, they're missing combined $21 trillion. And that's just two of the 17 agencies. And you go, okay, well, we haven't even gotten around to the others. So we can make an assumption that we're talking $100 trillion plus dollars of missing money. It goes, you start to get on the case, they change FASB 56, make it so you can't, you can't read anything. It's all garbage. So we know the money's, we know the money exists. We know the money went out the back door. The intro to this podcast has an audio clip of Rumsfeld talking about the missing money that they can't account for. So we know there's the money is there. And I think you guys make a pretty good case that that's what it's going towards, or at least in at least a chunk of that towards some of this secret, not, I don't know if secret space program, non-public facing space program. Is that, would that be a good assessment?
Yes, insofar as it goes, that's really the reason that Catherine and I bumped into each other. Is, you know, we're kind of like two people in a cartoon with flashlights, and we're looking in this dark room, and we're backing into each other,
right?
Because this is literally the way it happened. Because she's looking at all of this missing money, and saying, "What in the name of sense are they?" are they doing with all of this? And I'm thinking, okay, we're going to, you know, we've got a UFO problem after World War II, and you've got a bunch of Nazis and people like Alan Dulles, you know, who, as far as I'm concerned, might as well be a Nazi.
I don't make the differentiation between Alan Dulles being a potential working with Nazis and being one himself.
You've got all of these people in the American establishment that are going to view the UFO problem as part of the strategic threat complex that they have to deal with after World War II. So what are they going to do? Well, in my thinking, the thing that they're going to do is they're going to set up a long-term mega Manhattan project to emulate the characteristics of UFOs by technological means if they can. And the reason they're going to do that is by showing that you have parity or near parity. What you're doing is you're playing a bit of gunboat diplomacy, and you're warding off whoever you think might be behind that. So they're going to need lots of money. You know, they're going to need money on a scale that dwarfs the Manhattan Project, and they're going to need it for a long time. And they can't go to the American people and say, oh, we're going to increase your taxes 253% because we need to fight flying saucers. That's not going to sell after World War II. So this is what they did. They, in my reasoning, they essentially set up a massive hidden system of finance, using in part recovered Axis loot to do it. And to set up this hidden system of finance, basically you're saying that they're setting up a hidden bond market. They're getting certain central banks and large prime banks in the Western financial system to go along with this. This is effectively what I think they did. So this is how Fitz and I backed into each other. And over the years, as we've discussed this problem, the other problem is this. If you view this amount, this literal mountain range of money as an electrical circuit, you're putting all that money as power into the power end. Where's the load end? Somewhere, even on the basis of a hidden system of finance, that money has to manifest in the circuit. It should have and here's the problem. It should have manifested long ago as a Weimar Republic style hyperinflation.
Right.
Long ago.
It didn't, because nobody knew it was missing.
Well, no, it's not just that, because even if you don't know what's missing, it's still going to manifest itself if it's still in the circuit.
But if you take it out of the circuit and keep
it hidden, bingo. There you go. Where did it go? In other words, is a lot of our money literally disappearing off planet?
Wow.
This planet is a closed circuit. At least that's what we've been told.
Yeah.
And here's the other problem. You remember the financial meltdown in 2008? Okay. And I'm watching this, Charlie, and I'm thinking, these guys, you know, I'm watching these guys before Congress, and I'm thinking, who's got the gun to their head? Remember they were talking about, oh, we can't have any oversight. Don't want that.
Yeah.
And I think, what's the gun? Why?
Yeah.
Why do they not want any oversight? I suspect it's because that money is going off planet. Now, here's why. During that financial crisis, we were told that the derivatives sloshing around on the financial system books were somewhere between 14 and 17 quadrillion dollars, which is several times the gross domestic product of the entire planet.
Right.
Okay. Right. And I'm thinking, okay, how could you let a finance system get away with that much bad paper? How are you going to get rid of it? And then lo and behold, within months, what do we start seeing? We start seeing, oh, this asteroid out there is worth, by golly, what an amazing coincidence, $14 quadrillion.
Yes. You know?
And we started talking about asteroid mining. So I'm thinking, okay, these people have collateralized space.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to know why I think that?
Please.
Go back to the first bearer bonds scandals. Remember those? I've been watching those because to me, they're fascinating. If you want an indicator that they've got this big, huge system of finance that they don't want anybody to know about and that they're actually trading paper while they want the rest of us to be trading with electronic blips, here's why. If you go back to the first bearer bond scandal, when that group of Japanese men were caught by the Italian financial police crossing the border into Switzerland with a false bottom in their briefcase with $134 billion worth of bearer bonds denominated in $1 billion. Remember, Obama had to give a press conference denying that these things are even real. Okay.
That's how you know they're real.
Press conference to say that they're not real, that's how you know they're. Well, if you look at the bonds that were allegedly recovered, there's a picture of President Kennedy on the front of these fake bonds. Now, in my opinion, they are fake. Okay. It's a very complicated story, but they're fakes of something real because you don't counterfeit $7 bills.
Right.
Okay. You only counterfeit things that are real. On the back of this thing, what do you see? You see the space shuttle. You see the surface of the moon. And you see the lunar excursion module.
Really? On the back of the bonds?
On the back of a $1 billion bond. Now, to me, that's the clue that what they did was they collateralized space. They took a book out of the playbook of the old sovereign republic of Venice, where the banksters would loan money to the merchants to go get spices and slaves and what else for a cut of the action. That's exactly what they've done. So, in other words, they not only have to go out to space, or claim to be going out there and getting all of this stuff. That's the other thing. We're dealing with liars, frauds, and cheats. So don't forget that part of the story, folks. But they've now got to do it. And if they're going to do that, that means they have to weaponize it.
And it takes us back kind of full circle to the Nazi thing where you've got Wernher von Braun and Carol Rawson talking about the terrorist threat. And then everyone goes, oh, and then it's Project Bluebeam. No, there's one in between. It's the asteroid.
It's asteroids. Right. Wow. Ding, ding, ding. Ding, ding, ding.
Okay, so this is intergalactic money laundering.
Yeah, I really think that there's some aspect of this vast system that's already gone off planet, which then implies the question, okay, who's honoring our money?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, who's that? And what happens when they find out it's worthless?
Yeah.
it poses a little problem. So, you know, I think they've gotten themselves in so deep. Even if all of this is false, in other words, if they're not sending money off planet and so on and so forth, they've got to do it anyway. Even if there's no ET, they've got to do this. Their books are that bad.
Just to keep the con going. This is a Ponzi scheme that needs new
blood.
Needs
new money. Needs new resources. Needs more gold. Needs more bullion. Yeah, bingo, precisely.
What is the role then of this pivot to the privatization of space with SpaceX and Blue Origins and the like?
What better way to keep us deplorables from having our dirty, grubby little eyes on the whole thing?
Make it private.
FASB 56, digital currency, corporate coupons. You know, you will own nothing and you will be happy. Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
I have to tell you this as an aside, since we're wrapping up here. I went out this weekend with my family and we saw Top Gun, the new Top Gun movie. And in the beginning scene of it, and I'm not giving anything away for those that haven't seen it, Tom Cruise's character is flying a plane, and he's contractually obligated to try and get it to Mach 10. And as he's flying this plane, on two different occasions, I caught the Skunk Works logo in it.
Oh, I can believe it. I can believe it. Yeah. You know about all the alleged statements that Ben Rich supposedly made before his death.
Yes.
Yeah. We found an error in the equations and now we can take ET home. Things like that.
I wasn't sure what plane he was flying in this. It looked like it looked a little bit like the Aurora project. It might have been a fake one made for this thing, but it most definitely had the skunk, and I saw it twice and I thought he's working out in some, you know, in the Mojave Desert. I said, well, I know he's Lancaster.
I tend to think most of our post-war technological history is one big lie. The amount of stuff that we got from the Nazis at the end of the war is truly breathtaking. And, you know, they brought it to quite a pitch of development during the war. And then when you take all those people and supply them with limitless amounts of Federal Reserve notes, yeah, they can do a lot in that time. So I think we're looking at the possibility that this stuff is ready to take off. And you asked a very good question about why the privatization. And I think the privatization is, there's no better way to keep something secret than make it proprietary.
Yeah.
Making it a corporate secret rather than a government one. I mean, this government leaks like a sieve.
Yeah. You would need to, take it out of the hands of the government, given the current state of affairs in this government. Say what you will about the old timey OSS and they could keep a secret, you know, but these groups.
Well, yeah, you're right. Would you want the current alleged president to have their hands anywhere close to the nuclear button?
No. I'd rather Jeff Bezos have it, and I don't feel very comfortable with him.
No, I don't either. But this guy, no. No, it's immense. The government, what all of this boils down to is that the governance structure of the world is very, very different than the public face of it. And a lot of that structure has to deal with this hidden system of finance and the hidden technology that we assume that they've been able to purchase through it. And that's scary because it means that policymaking is also being made ultimately by people from a very different culture than what you and I are familiar with. It literally is a breakaway civilization rather than just a breakaway group. You know, they've got their own mores, they've got their own way that they think and handle things. And that's when it gets right down to it, that's very scary.
You've written 37 books, Cracking the Code, digging into this. For anybody for anybody that is interested, GizaDeathStar.com is the place to go to follow Dr. Farrell's work, to support his work by buying his books. And your work has been, in my opinion, probably the most interesting that I followed. I really am fascinated with the things that you're into. I also happen to be into, and the things that you're into that I'm not into, I just don't know I'm into them yet. So I'll get around to them and figure it out. That's Dr. Joseph P. Farrell, everybody. He's been writing about this for a very long time. If you like this episode, take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can follow me on Twitter at macroaggression. The website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thank you, everybody. We'll talk to you soon.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest. Life comes at you fast, which is why it's important to find some time to relax. A little you time. Enter Chumba Casino. With no download required, you can jump on anytime, anywhere for the chance to redeem some serious prizes. So treat yourself with Chumba Casino and play over 100 online casino-style games, all for free. Go to ChumbaCasino.com to collect your free welcome bonus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.